Now, in this process which you have just described so well, Berg, do you think the advertiser, and he's the man we're talking about today, do you think the advertiser has any special ethical responsibility? What do you think, Walt?
Well, I would like to say something about what Berg has just mentioned. His statement overall, I think, may be relatively true, but there is another side to the picture that ought to be pointed out. When you can take 2 cents worth of chemicals and put them in a glass bottle that costs 10 cents and sell them for a dollar and a half, the demand hoped up by special types of advertising, that is not the kind of thing that is likely to keep the wheels of industry turning or keep people employed. That kind of thing simply means that people are buying something which is way overpriced because advertising has told them something about it. And this is not an isolated example.
Now, you're beginning to discuss the ethical responsibilities of the advertisers. You see them.
Yes, and I want to say that I think that although much of what Berg says is true, we must not overlook the other side of the picture, that advertising is not all one rosy, happy family that's keeping us free and a liberal nation.
In a free, competitive system, it won't be very long before some other manufacturer comes along and manufactures and sells that item at a lower price, if the people really want it.
But he can't sell it without advertising, as both of you gentlemen have agreed already. And if he doesn't have the advertising budget to start off with, if he can't get the space, if we don't give the consumer informative advertising, then you don't have a free competitive market.
Products that do not warrant the goodwill of the American public doesn't last long.
I can give you examples, Mr. Berg, of a product, a particular mouthwash or certain toothpaste or certain types of patent medicines that have lasted for a long, long time, and they've lasted on the grounds of making claims which are shady, to say the very least.
You're suggesting that the advertiser takes unfair advantage of the psychological weakness of potential consumers.
He scares people.
Well, I disagree with that. You better say some advertisers. Don't include the majority of them. Certainly not a concern like ours and many other nationally known blue-chip concerns that I could refer to. They're honest. They're sincere. They tell the truth.
I would agree with that, but I would also say that this power of being able to scare people is an effective one, and therefore a potentially dangerous power. If you can convince people that they will not get a bride or a bridegroom unless they happen to use a particular dentifrice, then you see you're doing something which is dishonest. And even if this is not contained as a promise within the advertisement, if it is only implied, the same type of dishonesty is present.
Mr. Walton, please, we mustn't judge all of the people by the few.
I'm talking about rather big industries now. You know about the TV scare. You know about what the mouthwashes have claimed. You know about what the cosmetic claims are.
No, I'm not familiar with
it. Then you ought to read the advertisements in the magazines rather carefully in your home, because you'll be surprised at what some advertisers will promise you.
I do read the advertisers in the magazines, and whenever I see an ad over the signature of a substantial concern, I take every word as the gospel.
Do you mean that there, for example, in the recent issue of Vogue, there was a concern which is nationwide known as a substantial concern in cosmetics? This concern promised all women, not just some, but all women, that they could be beautiful if they would use their product.
Well, Mr. Wallen,
this is said to be a solemn promise.
Yeah, Mr. Wallen, in my estimation, all women are beautiful.
And beauty certainly is a relative thing.
The advertiser didn't put it that way.
What do you have to say about this, Manny?
Well, I was.
You think all women are beautiful?
Well, I think it's up to what they look like to another hippopotamus. But it is relative. But I'm particularly interested in Wallen's comment about the TV campaign taking advantage of parents' solicitude for their children. I'd like to point out that there was quite an uproar in the advertising industry about that campaign, and that it was stopped very quickly by pressure from within the industry and from the public. And that's the sort of pressure that ought to operate on those things.
Precisely the same type of advertising has been used by soap concerns, and it's been used by mouthwash concerns to convince people that unless they use that particular product, they would not have some of the advantages of life that other people would have.
But haven't these appeals to emotion and suggestion been used from public platforms, by political orators, by advocates of all kinds throughout the history of the mouth? Are you saying that the use of suggestion and appeals to emotion
are reprehensible because they distort people's choices in the marketplace. Is that your idea?
I'm not saying that they are reprehensible per se. What I'm getting at is that it's an entirely different matter if a man on a platform chooses to use emotional appeals than it is if a man with $1 million a year advertising budget chooses to use them for a product for which exaggerated claims or misleading claims are being made. Then people do not have a free choice because they have no choice except to believe the things that are told them.
But what happens in the courtroom when you have lawyers appealing to a jury? You have emotional appeals, you have suggestion use. Yet the assumption underlying our system of jurisprudence is that by and large, out of these classes of opinions and appeals, truth and justice will emerge.
Both sides get a chance to present their case in the courtroom of Bernie's. Both sides do not get a chance to present their case in the advertising channel.
Is that really true?
Well, I agree that the seller has some responsibilities because he has the advantage over the buyer of the product in that he can present his claims and without having an opportunity for a rebuttal or discussion. But I'd like to also mention the fact that presenting of claims in an advertisement in a magazine or over television or radio does not mean that makes the final sale decision. There are so many things that happen between that point and the final purchase at the point of sale that advertising becomes a tool to get people to come to a store to look at the goods and to talk to the salesman rather than make the sale complete.
I'd like to salvage something from my analogy with the courtroom. Is it strictly true that in the marketplace there is no competition such as exists in the courtroom? That is, you have toothless advertisers. They're perceiving us to buy this toothpaste, that toothpaste, somebody else's toothpaste.
There is competition, but it happens that the competition is not the sort that allows the consumer to make up his mind. And furthermore, as I've tried to point, it's competition among monsters. It is not competition among all people who can make a product. He who has the largest advertising budget is a man who wins.
Well, of course, I disagree violently with Mr. Walden. Our company was built on the foundation of advertising, and we lean over backwards to be ultra-conservative in the statements we make. By the way, is advertising on trial here today? Is that what we're talking about, or are we...
We're asking, does advertising provide a better way of life?
Well,
and I think we're largely agreed, if I sense correctly the feeling around the table, that it does, in terms of providing greater prosperity. I do think Wallen wants to enter a certain demur. That is, he suggests that in certain areas that the advertisers haven't been quite as responsible as they ought to be, and that's the question that we're pursuing. Now, there's a related question that I'd like to ask you, Mr. Burke. Does it make any difference to you what people buy as long as they buy?
Well, as long as they buy our product, I don't know.
Now, this is exactly the kind of attitude, Miss Burney, that I think activates every manufacturer. And I think that probably Berg would not object to a manufacturer saying that. But suppose that you have a product which actually is harmful or injurious to people, and there are many instances of exactly that kind. They take the same attitude that Berg does, saying it doesn't make any difference what they buy as long as they buy our product.
What do you mean by harmful, Mr. Wallen? What product?
There are several kinds of damage that can accrue from using certain types of products. One of them is that it keeps the individual from getting the proper type of treatment that he needs, particularly in the case of certain kinds of patent medicine.
I knew you.
Another example, however, is that in which there is actually a toxic content to the compound which is taken in the body.
I just knew Mr. Wallen was going to bring up this patent medicine. And, of course, you understand, Mr. Wallen, that there are many publishing houses who will not accept patent medicine advertising. They don't believe in it. You can't judge all good advertising, 98% of it, by the 2% bad advertising that we've been talking about around here for the last 10 minutes.
It may be 2%, but one president of one firm has made $5 million on a product which contains only a modicum of vitamins and 15% alcohol.
Well, I think I know just the product you're referring to.
too.
That doesn't mean the product doesn't do some people some good.
And that doesn't mean that the product's going to be around very long.
I think we can prove to the contrary that the ingestion of any such small amount of favorable medications contained in that particular product would not do anybody any good.
What about the psychological benefit?
Then in that particular case, then, I think that you are really guilty of something that's wrong. If you're selling distilled water and it makes people feel better and you're charging $1 a bottle for it, then I think there is an ethical issue involved.
Well, a lot of people do buy distilled water.
I mean, under the assumption that it's something that will do you some good. I'm not talking about labeled distilled water.
Well, it will do you good. Now Wallen's case here begins to take shape. Let me ask statistically, what are some of the effects imposed on advertising? Do you think most people are capable, Maddox, of evaluating advertisements? How gullible are people anyway?
I think they're a great deal less gullible than Mr. Wallen indicates. You have heard many people, at least I have, pick up an ad and say baloney, where the claims are exaggerated. Even small children can get that out.
Now, you see, Mr. Maddox is reversing his field. A little earlier, advertising was the thing that was going to save the national economy. Now he's saying it's not very effective and people don't believe it. Well, I want to know where you stand, Mr. Maddox.
I say there are certain instances that you have pointed out where advertising overreaches itself, but they represent a minority of advertising. The great bulk of advertising is factual and informative and does bolster the economy.
That's correct. Now, Bridge, you see, has made the point, Wallen, that many sellers are interested in preserving the integrity of their products and preserving their name. That's been your point, hasn't it?
Oh, definitely so. The more advertising we do, the more business we do, the more business we do, the more funds we have for research and for field service and for the stability of the company behind the product and all those things.
Well, then can we say this sort of thing? Mr. Berg represents the best point of view in advertising, that is, in an effort to be honest and informative. Can we say then, at least this, that some advertising contributes to a better way of life, but certainly we can't say that all does?
Well, I think you ought to know that there is a very vigorous activity in the advertising business which seeks self-regulation. There are committees in the American Association of Advertising Agencies which have no other purpose but to police the industry.
Well, I would like to say this, that unless we continue to advertise, and aggressively, the businessmen of America, the wheels of industry will slow down, unemployment will increase, and we will not have the conditions such as we have today.
I would like to have Mr. Maddox tell us what it was in the advertising industry that brought about this great desire for self-regulation. What was happening?
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but our time is up. You've been listening to the transcribed Northwestern University Review and Stand discussion, Does Advertising Provide a Better Way of Life? Why not send now for a printed copy of this broadcast with a list of books and articles about the subject discussed. Copies may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. A subscription to the Review and Stand costs $1 for the next 4 months, $2.50 for an entire year. Write to the Review and Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Our guests today were John S. Maddox, Cy Berg, and Richard Wallen. The Reviewing Stand wishes to take this opportunity to express its appreciation to the management and staff of radio station WHK in Cleveland and the Cleveland Advertising Club for their cooperation in making this broadcast possible. Next week, the Reviewing Stand will discuss the question, Can We Prevent Alcoholism? Our guests will be Anton J. Carlson, Elvin M. Jelinek, Jeffrey Mapes, and Dr. Julius Masterman. We invite you to listen next week for a discussion of the question, Can We Prevent Alcoholism? The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast every week as a public service feature of Mutual. Your announcer is Jerry Crawford. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.